Iran's foreign minister says his country is ready to facilitate talks between the Afghan government and Taliban militants. Israeli soldiers kill a Palestinian following an alleged knife attack near the occupied West City of Bethlehem. And Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi defends his government's agricultural policies despite weeks of protests by farmers. Appreciate you being with us. Well, Iran's foreign minister says his country is ready to facilitate talks between the Afghan government and Taliban militants. Mohammad Javad Zarif has said in an exclusive government, an inclusive government should be formed in Afghanistan with the participation of all ethnic and political groups. He urged the Taliban to focus on an immediate end to problems of Afghans so that the establishment of peace strip outsiders of a pretext to occupy Afghanistan. The top Iranian diplomat made the remarks in a meeting with the Taliban delegation in Tehran. The delegation was led by the head of the Taliban's political bureau, Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar. He said the formation of an inclusive government is required for the establishment of peace in Afghanistan. Crossing over to Brussels, joined by Elijah Magni, a journalist and political analyst. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, let's talk about the significance of this meeting here in Tehran today between Iran's foreign minister and Taliban representatives.
It is very important for the countries of the region to sort out their problems without an outside interference. This is what is pushing Iran to support the Afghan internal talk between the Taliban and the Afghani government, regardless what the role of the U.S. Government can be. Because we saw that the U.S. is saying, we want to withdraw, we don't want to withdraw, we want to review, we would like to keep some forces to fight terrorism. So we can, the countries of the region cannot rely on foreign forces to sort out their own problem. This is why it is the best way is for Afghanistan to be in contact with its neighboring like Iran, like Russia, like Pakistan, to sort out their problems and to make sure there is a valid and adequate mediation to bring all the parties together around the table and hold a domestic talk among the Afghani without outside forces, particularly the US or Europe.
Well, the United States, of course, has been in, they've been involved in Afghanistan for a couple of decades now. And we know that the Taliban is involved with, in talks with Washington. At the end of the day, I know you talked about the United States wanting to keep soldiers there, keep troops there. But at the end of the day, when they have been involved in these talks, what do you think is the actual goal of these talks? If it's not really to bring peace and stability to Afghanistan, why are in the process? Why are they in the process of having these talks?
This is not the first time of the Afghan delegation of a high representative of Taliban visiting Iran. Iran has been trying to sort out the Afghan problem and trying to mediate between the government and Taliban. It is important because, as the Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, the Americans should leave West Asia, should leave the area, because the American role, as it was in 1979, contributed in after 1981, the Russian occupation of Afghanistan. They formed the Taliban, they armed the Taliban, and then, as Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said, the people we are fighting today are the same people we have funded. So the Americans come to the Middle East and to West Asia, fund a group of people, arm them, and then these people want their independence, they turn against the Americans, and then the Americans want other countries to sort out their problems, and then they send troops and kill more of the locals. This is what's happening. So when Iran is interfering in Afghan Afghanistan, according to the request of the Afghani government and the Taliban and the parties involved that are finding it difficult to sort out their problem on their own, is a constructive intervention to bring party together so they can find a solution, and Iran can only ease the differences and find a common ground for these people. It's very important, like Iran is trying to find a solution with the Arab countries like Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and the other countries, so to take away the excuse of the Americans that are saying you cannot solve your problems on your own. On the contrary, the countries of the region, in the Middle East, in the Persian Gulf, and in Afghanistan, they can sort out their problems if the Americans step aside and leave the area.
Would you say that that is the key factor for them being able to reach a solution and have stability in Afghanistan, is basically the United States leaving West Asia?
Yes, of course, because we don't have a very reliable version from the U.S. We looked at the JCPOA, the nuclear deal. One president signed it, another president revokes it. A new president says, I want to review it and change it. And now we have Jack Sullivan, who is the Biden National Security Advisor, saying, I want to review the deal and maybe we will keep forces. So they're not telling the truth, and they don't have a very clear strategy. And why the countries of the region need to depend on the Americans, who should leave the area and stop their intervention that is always negative. They won wars, but they never won a peace. They never managed to bring population together and create a peace among the population. We saw that in Syria. We saw that in Iraq. We saw that in Afghanistan. We saw that destructive role in the Middle East. The Americans should leave the area and allow the population and the leaders to sort out their problems alone.
Thanks so much for being with us out of Brussels, Elijah Magni, a journalist and political analyst. Meanwhile, foreign troops in Afghanistan plan to stay there beyond a May deadline set at a deal between Taliban militants and the U.S. That's according to several NATO officials. The officials have said international forces would not fully withdraw by April end, saying conditions are yet to be met. They told Reuters that with the new administration in the U.S., there will be changes, and NATO needs a more calculated exit strategy. Former U.S. President Donald Trump and Taliban militants signed a deal back in February of last year. The Taliban pledged certain security guarantees in return for the full withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan. Now the new pullout plan is expected to escalate tensions there. The Taliban and the U.S. have already accused each other of violating the deal. Israeli forces have killed a Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank city of Bethlehem. The Israeli army said the Palestinian man died from his wounds after troops shot him at close range at a bus stop in the Gush Etzion area south of Bethlehem. Well, the army claimed the man had tried to stab the troops. Israeli troopers frequently shoot Palestinians across the occupied territories, citing similar allegations. Gush Etzion has been a flashpoint of such attacks. On January the 5th, Israeli soldiers shot dead another Palestinian in that area. Earlier, Mona Kandil joined us from Ramallah. She gave us more details about the latest Palestinian killing at the hands of Israeli troops in the West Bank.
The Israeli army said the man was neutralized. This means that he was shot and killed at the spot. The Palestinian Ministry of Health confirmed that they were informed by the Palestinian liaison that a Palestinian man was shot dead at the Gush Etzion Junction. However, his identity was not known yet. The Israelis claimed that the man was attempting to use a knife. Attempted knife stabbing, according, of course, to the Israeli soldier. However, none of the Israeli soldiers were injured in this attack. As you were saying, the Gush Etzion junction is very important. It's in the middle area leading to Beit Lahem, to Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron. And at the same time, it's the center of a number of numerous Israeli settlements around the area on the mountains.
The Indian Prime Minister has accused farmers who have been protesting against new farm laws for months now of causing insult to the country by storming the capital's landmark, the Red Fort. Narendra Modi also defended his government's policies, saying it is committed to modernizing agriculture. His comments came just days after a tractor rally by farmers on the country's Republic Day turned violent, leaving one person dead and hundreds of others injured. Some protesters also broke into the historic Red Fort complex. On Saturday, they also observed a day-long mass hunger strike coinciding with the death anniversary of the father of the nation, Mahatma Gandhi. Tens of thousands of farmers have camped out on the outskirts of New Delhi, demanding the government repeal the new laws. They argue that the agricultural reforms would leave them at the mercy of big corporations. Nearly a dozen rounds of talks between farmers and government representatives have failed to make a breakthrough. Myanmar's Rohingya Muslim population has been going through tough times in the past years. In August of 2017, hundreds of thousands of them fled an army crackdown in their homeland and took refuge in neighboring Bangladesh. Since then, the Rohingya have lived in overcrowded camps in Bangladesh. Now, authorities there have begun relocating them to a remote, uninhabited island, despite calls to stop the move.
Bangladesh's government sent another group of Rohingya Muslim refugees to a remote and deserted island in the Bay of Bengal. More than 1,400 refugees set sail for the island of Basanchar. It was the fourth group sent to the island, and the Bangladeshi government plans to eventually move 100,000 Rohingya to the remote island. Bangladesh also aims to decongest refugee camps in Cox's Bazar, which shelters approximately 1 million Rohingya. The relocations began in December and have been criticized by human rights groups who say that many of the refugees are being forced to move against their will. The government of Bangladesh says the relocation is voluntary, but many refugees have talked about the move as being coerced. Rights organizations say the Bangladeshi government used cash incentives as well as intimidation tactics to force Rohingya to accept the relocation offer. Bangladeshi authorities say the relocation is essential to ensure better living conditions for the refugees and to improve the camps in Cox's Bazar.
As a matter of fact, Bangladesh and India were among the countries which from the beginning opposed the incoming of these refugees. As a matter of fact, they identified them as terrorists and they did not give them what their rights under international law and under the humanitarian law as refugees. And we've seen that it's continuing. They see the Rohingya Muslims as a problem rather than sort of oppressed people that they need to be supported at this hour of need.
The refugee camp became overcrowded from August 2017 when Rohingya Muslims began fleeing their homes in Rakhine State following waves of attacks by Myanmar's army and Buddhist mobs. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims were violently uprooted in the months that followed, driven by a brutal military crackdown that killed thousands of them. What happened in August 2017 was so horrific that the UN called it genocide and a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Those who survived the brutal killings sought refuge in Bangladesh and neighboring countries, hoping for a day to return home. But for now, it seems that thousands of them have to go on yet another perilous journey.
Well, where is the new place that Rohingya Muslim refugees are being located to? The new destination came into existence only 2 decades ago. It's reportedly prone to natural disasters like cyclones and flooding. No one had lived on the island before the construction of settlements for the Rohingyas began there. Now, the plight of the Rohingya Muslims has been running for a long time. They're considered as the world's most persecuted minority group, and their relocation by Bangladesh to a remote island is just the latest in the difficulties they've been facing. Are the Rohingya being moved to a place that will eventually lead to their death?
The Rohingya are the world's most persecuted ethnic minority, haunted by the past and denied a future. A citizenship law in 1982 stripped them of the nationality, making them one of the world's largest stateless communities. While there have been waves of exodus to Bangladesh since the 1970s, none was as rapid and massive as the one in August 2017 that turned the spotlight on the Rohingya crisis around the world. Today, Bangladesh alone is home to nearly a million Rohingya refugees. At least half of those who arrived in the country were children. The UN says the migration was unprecedented in terms of volume and speed. These people know that they cannot stay in Cox's Bazar forever, but it seems that they are not wanted anywhere in this world.
Well, they're not really stateless in reality. They have a right to be its citizens of Myanmar. They've been denied that basic fundamental right. It's not the fact that, by history, they are stateless. Their citizenship has been denied. And you're absolutely right. That is the heart of the problem. And it will not be resolved unless the international community force the Myanmar government to rise up and accept their responsibility for looking after their own citizens.
There were talks of the Rohingya repatriation for the past couple of years, but to this day, nothing has happened. The main reason is that Myanmar's government was always unwilling to accept the refugees. Bangladesh has time and again pushed hard to begin the repatriation, but Myanmar has been delaying it, saying that it needs more time for logistical arrangements. The Rohingya Muslims also fear for their safety in case they return to their country. A UN fact-finding mission in Myanmar says that approximately 600,000 Rohingya are still inside the country, living under the threat of genocide. The world body says no refugees will agree to be repatriated without assurance of full citizenship, ethnic rights, to settle back in Myanmar. Given the Myanmar's leaders' reluctance to address the issue, the minority group's fate is a major cause for concern that is only being voiced by a select group of countries around the world.
Continue with other news now this hour. A huge blast has rocked Somalia's capital, Mogadishu. The cause of the explosion is still unclear, but witnesses say they heard the sound of gunfire following the blast. No immediate casualties have been reported. Now, Somalia has been the scene of increasing attacks and bombings in recent months. They were all claimed by Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab group. Al-Shabaab has been engaged in a bloody militancy in Somalia since 2006 in an attempt to undermine the central government. Russia has slammed the U.S. over its condemnation of Moscow's response to protests in support of detained Kremlin opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Russia has accused the U.S. of gross interference in its internal affairs. It said the U.S.'s support for the unauthorized rallies is another confirmation of its role behind the scenes. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has condemned what he called Russia's persistent use of harsh tactics against peaceful protesters and journalists. Navalny's supporters have taken to the streets for a second straight weekend to protest against his detention. During the latest rally, some 3,000 people were arrested across Russia. Navalny was arrested earlier this month after returning from Germany. And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin.
Epic, glory, honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Bahman, the غیرت شور غزل غزل آی بنو از ابتدا تا انتها مردمی از جنس غرور
See the world through IRIB English Radio, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Imam Khomeini, beloved leader. Of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today is the first day of the 10 days dawn, which marks the period in which the Islamic revolution of the Iranian people triumphed over the oppressive Pahlavi regime and put an end to 2,500 years of tyranny and oppression for good. 12 of Bahman, or February 1st, 1979, was the day on which the beloved leader of the Iranian people, Imam Khomeini, returned home from exile and accelerated the struggles against the remnants of the regime. Stay tuned for the first episode of this series, which deals briefly with the character of the Imam and the unmatched love of the people towards him. Imam Khomeini returned home after 15 years of exile with indescribable glory and magnanimity. When his plane landed, hearts started to beat strongly as people were impatiently waiting to meet their beloved leader. The distance of Mehrabad Airport to Behesht-e-Zahra Cemetery had been ornamented with flowers, and people were standing in several kilometers to see him. As the door of the Boeing 747 opened, Imam Khomeini appeared on the steps, as if rain was falling on thirsty souls. Ruhullah came, and a new chapter began. The Iranian nation found the call of truth in Imam's voice. They really felt that he was honest in fighting injustice and corruption. They saw that a man of Imam Hussein's descent had come to revive religious values even at the cost of his life and captivity of his family. That's why they accepted his call and struggled against tyranny and sacrificed their life in his way. The Islamic revolution shone like a sun on dormant hearts and breathed new spirit in the corpse of society, which had become wary of oppression, discrimination, corruption, and evil. Since day one, Imam Khomeini taught the people that to cry the motto of independence, freedom, and Islamic Republic on the basis of the principle of neither East nor West, Islamic is the best. Sayyid Murtaza Avini, whom Ayatollah Khamenei called as the master of the men of letters, described Imam Khomeini in one of his books as follows. Imam Khomeini was not a new messenger, but he was among the reminders, who reminded people of their innate covenant with God. And after centuries of mankind's collective decadence, just like his predecessors, Abraham, Ishmael, and Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, broke an era of ignorance and initiated another era. Dear friends, Imam Khomeini, like his pure forefathers, was in pursuit of training and expurgation of individuals and society. God makes it clear in the Quran that government and politics are not separate from morality and human virtues. Verse 21 of chapter Ahzab reads, "In the apostle of Allah there is certainly for you a good exemplar." Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, was the best role model of an Islamic governor. After him, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, demonstrated the most beautiful manifestations of social justice and human magnanimity in the Islamic governance. Imam Khomeini too strove to revive and promote religious values in society. He possessed the lofty merits of an Islamic ruler himself. Since his adolescence, he had tried hard to train his soul in full conformity with moralities and piety. His classmates and friends all testified that he was an embodiment of human virtues. They focused on two characteristics in the Imam, namely midnight vigil for prayer and supplication at the divine court and serious refraining from backbiting or listening to backbiting. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, was a very truthful and honest man. He was an example of Imam Ali's word. Honesty is the strongest support of faith. Whatever Imam Khomeini preached, he would do it himself. If he advised the officials to lead a simple life, he had a simple life himself. In fact, his honesty was the main factor for people's endless love for him. Imam Khomeini would say, "If you call me servant, it would be better than calling me leader." Imam Khomeini would pay a lot of attention to the poor and the deprived classes. He used to remind the officials to be at the service of the poor and the oppressed. Once he said, "It is our duty and the duty of all officials to serve these people and share their sorrows, happiness, and problems. I don't think there is any worship better than serving the deprived." Ayatollah Khamenei says, "There were three beliefs in the Imam which gave him decisiveness, courage, and steadfastness: the belief in God, the belief in people, and the belief in himself. These three beliefs were manifest in the true sense of the word, in being Imam and all his moves." Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini was a real Gnostic, but he had not isolated himself from the society. He was in the middle of developments and enjoyed a very high political acumen. He was a very charismatic, disciplinary, and orderly figure. Since his youth, he had prepared a table for his daily affairs and had arranged his hours in an exact order. His pupils and classmates say that he was so orderly and on time that they could say the hour according to his activities. One of his daughters, Zahra Mustafavi, says, "The Imam was so exact and orderly that if he delayed 5 minutes for lunch, everybody at home would be worried." Let us end this program with the remarks of Ayatollah Khamenei on Imam Khomeini. The reason why a word of our great Imam had an astonishing impact on the vast atmosphere of the country was his spirituality, his inward purity, his bond and connection with God, his midnight tears. That iron man, the man who would not move by events and harms which could move a nation, the man in whose eyes the awe and pomp of the global powers were not, used to shed tears humbly before the divine greatness.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we witnessed that abuse by law enforcement officers in the United States is one of the most serious and divisive human rights violations in the country, as U.S. police is killing black people at persistently high rates. What is clear is that racism is at the very heart of the issue, as statistics show that black people are 3 times more likely to be killed by police than white people. What is worse is that even black children are being targeted. Yet the people have not been silent. They have organized in what is known as the Black Lives Matter campaign to get the message across that all lives are of equal value, no matter the color of the skin. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
We're just going over some things for the vigil. It's going to be in Nicholas Hayward Jr. Park. That's in Brooklyn. He was murdered by the police, 13-year-old murdered by the police for like really similar circumstances, very close parallel to what was happening with what happened with Tamir Rice. So it's important for me, I think, that that place be chosen and that his story be highlighted.
So to that end, I'm always trying to connect the dots so that people see, yes, this is a national issue, but this is also a local issue. So his father's going to be speaking. We'll have a prayer by Pastor Omar, words from Mr. Hayward, I'm sorry, and then I'll close out talking about the national epidemic of police violence against children. And this is why I wanted us to meet, so that we could talk about things that I may be overlooking. Well, for one, I've applied for a PIT permit with the Parks Department. You guys know that's always important to me, but I also wanted to get your input on that. We had issues with the permit, with the march, lots of fighting with the Parks Department and the Police Department. And so they haven't been responsive yet, so I'm wondering if we're going to encounter the same issues that we did with the 4-mile march. The reason why I choose places of public accommodation is because we have a legal right to be there. And so, like, you know, there's nothing that they can really do about us exercising our First Amendment right within the space of public accommodation.
I'm really glad that the weather held up.
Thank God, because yesterday was terrible.
Yeah, I thought it was going to rain.
Imagine if yesterday would have been today.
Probably. Yeah, and lugging all of this stuff in the rain, and I know it would have been a terrible turnout.
Just get ponchos.
Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, people don't show up when it's rainy or cold, so I'm really glad that people have, you know, I think we're going to have a good turnout.
So I'm really excited working with Leah because, you know, you saw her. She's going to be having the weatherproof posters of the children and their stories.
She did a great job.
Yeah. I think that'll be powerful with it tied, like, on the fence so that passerbys, you know, will wonder and come and look, and then they can read the stories.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. She also did an art installation on the floor where she got age-appropriate shoes, like the whatever size their shoe size would be at the age that they were killed, and she painted those white, and those are going to be there too. So it's going to really help you visualize how small these kids were.
children when their lives were stolen.
And I think it's good to focus on the children because this is something that can't be argued. Like,
exactly.
Even you can play devil's advocate, these are children.
Exactly.
Children
they're
are harmless, so...
Here today. Tamir Wright, 12 years old, playing with a toy gun in the park. The cops roll up on him, and in 2 seconds, they have killed him. 1001, 1002, Tamir is dead. And this is not an isolated incident. It happens all too often, and it must stop.
In September 1994, Nicholas Hayward Jr. was shot and killed in a public housing stairwell by an NYPD officer who mistook a plastic toy gun for a real one. Hayward was just 13 years old. Like so many other cases, no one was indicted in connection with the killing. In the 22 years since Hayward's death, his father has struggled with how and why his son died.
I cry a lot. It's hard to deal with losing a loved one. Nicholas was 13 years old. It pains me every time I hear of another victim being killed. My son was a great kid. He wasn't causing any harm to anyone. He was doing the right things. You know, he wasn't a danger or a threat to the officer that killed him. So, I mean, I feel that this is something that I have to do. I have to do this. We live in a society that continues to criminalize our youth, despite the fact how much effort they put forward to try to make their own life better. My son was doing the best that he can prior to him being killed. And he told the officer, we're only playing. And he shot and killed Nicholas in mid-sentence. And despite all of the witnesses who basically justified what Nicholas was doing, that he dropped the toy gun. They all told the district attorney he dropped the toy gun and the officer shot him anyway.
I think that actually there is a culture in police departments to protect each other so that when they engage in the use of arbitrary power, they come together, the code of silence, and refuse to allow us to find out exactly what goes on. I think they also have intimate connections to the judges and others. But I would say this, though, there's no doubt in my mind that there was an epidemic of shooting of precious, well-to-do white brothers and sisters. Police would be accountable. So even given the culture of the police departments that make it difficult for accountability to take place, it's also the fact that when it comes to poor black and brown peoples, that their lives matter less than the lives of well-to-do whites. And therefore, we have to make sure that there's fair policing rather than arbitrary policing. I think fair policing is police having a relationship with the community in which they're an organic part of that community. They are fighting crime. There's all kinds of forms of criminality, including criminality in the black community, criminality in Wall Street, criminality in professional circles and so forth. But police, unfortunately, over the years, have engaged in such massive arbitrary uses of power that the distrust cuts very, very deep. And of course, it's the backdrop of wealth inequality. It's a backdrop of a capitalist system that makes it very difficult for working peoples of any color to have their humanity affirmed. It's the backdrop of a system in which the opportunities are so limited, the decrepit school system, the massive unemployment, as well as massive underemployment. So we can't overlook the larger social context of the policing that goes on in America. But it can be much more fair than it is now.
Yeah. A state of emergency has been declared in the U.S. city of Baltimore after protesters clashed with police. It follows the funeral of Freddie Gray, who died in police custody over a week ago. The National Guard say that as many as 5,000 troops have been deployed amid the unrest.
Basically, also, since Monday, there's been a lot of speculation about what's going on out there, but basically, Freddie Gray, as we remember, we don't know why he was arrested, but he was stopped and he was arrested. And under police custody, his spine ended up being broken and he died from his injuries. So we just need to figure out what's going on, because there's a lot of things being said. We don't know if the youth, we don't know what's going on. We know that a CVS was destroyed. But, I mean, with the state of the Baltimore that I knew, I don't imagine that it could be much different from how it used to be. So I am going to head out there, see what's going on, see what I can learn from it, see how I can help, how I can support. But I just can't stay here in New York and not do anything at this point. So I'm heading out there.
Breaking news from Baltimore, a city on edge since the death of a suspect while in police custody, his spine nearly severed. Tonight, those tensions fueling violent protests now. Dramatic images coming in at this hour. You can see some people on the streets there throwing rocks and bricks at police officers.
On April 19th, 2015, 23-year-old Freddie Gray Jr., an African-American man, died in a Baltimore hospital after sustaining injuries while being transported in a police van. Gray had been arrested a week before by the Baltimore Police Department for possessing what the police said was an illegal switchblade. Gray's hospitalization and subsequent death resulted in an ongoing series of protests. On April 25th, 2015, a major protest in downtown Baltimore turned violent, resulting in 34 arrests and injuries to 15 police officers. After Gray's funeral on April 27th, civil disorder intensified with the looting and burning of local businesses and a drugstore, resulting in a state of emergency declared by Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. The Maryland National Guard was deployed to Baltimore, and a curfew was put into place.
I went there expecting the worst because I had seen the National Guard on TV and I had seen like how occupied they were by the military. So I was a little nervous when I got there, but surprisingly, it seemed that they were protecting mostly the harbor, the downtown harbor. That's where all of the National Guard really was, and it seemed that that was what their attention was focused on protecting. I think the media tried to kind of instill fear so that the same thing wouldn't happen in New York, but with Baltimore, it was the young children not feeling heard. It was mostly young children. All of the programs out there are cut for them. There's really nothing for them after school or part-time job-wise out there. So these children, they felt unheard, and their thing was to take to the streets. They were emotional. They started destroying, you know, things that they didn't feel were beneficial to the community.
The narrative around Baltimore, first of all, was that it was a riot. And I don't like that terminology because it's an uprising. It's cause and effect. When people are living in pervasive poverty and homelessness and joblessness, and on top of that, you add to that the current political climate where we see, not that it wasn't happening before, but where we see an overabundance of cops shooting and killing unarmed men, that was a natural response to those conditions. As with every other protest that has happened throughout this country in response to this issue, there was a negative slant put on it. They wanted to paint these people as savages instead of looking at the cause and effect. And they also didn't focus on the days that preceded what they call the riot, where people were actually in the streets peacefully protesting. So of course they're gonna spin it.
On May 21st, a grand jury indicted several of the officers involved with Gray's arrest. But in December 2015, a Baltimore judge declared a mistrial in the trial of one officer after the jury was unable to reach a verdict. The images of police wearing helmets and masks, toting assault rifles, and riding in mine-resistant armored vehicles in Baltimore and Ferguson has also raised widespread criticism of what has been dubbed the militarization of local police forces.
difference, I think, in the last 5 or 10 years, you've got the intense militarization of police departments. So the police department still engaged in arbitrary policing when I was growing up, but they didn't have the military equipment that they have now. And the very fact that what the last 10 years or so, every 28 hours, there's a black or brown person who's killed by a policeman security guard.
I think that military-grade equipment should be allocated to police department, but never, ever used against civilians. The military-grade equipment should be used in active shootings, shooter situation, terrorist attack, but never against a civilian unrest, and I, in my mind, it was a horrible error of judgment.
We need action. By action, I mean transformation of institutions. By action, I mean redistribution of the wealth downward. By action, I mean high-quality jobs, high-quality education. By action, I mean high-quality communities where people can live with dignity. By action, I mean police who are accountable, who are punished by law if they murder other folk, arbitrarily treat other folk in ways in which they ought not. So we're talking about just radical democracy. We need people's power. We need the sharing of power.
Unfortunately, I think that what we've seen with the killings of the officers in New York in 2014 and what we've seen in Dallas recently, unfortunately, I think that this is not the end of retaliation against law enforcement officers by certain individuals who feel that police profession and officers, no matter what department they come from, represent this oppressive and brutal treatment of minorities. After all, if somebody thinks about democracy and democratic principle and wanting to live in a democratic country, they have to realize that policing is a pillar of democracy. And if there are issues of concern, these issues of concern have to be discussed and have to be brought to the attention of the local politicians, but never, ever they should be translated into any violent behavior, especially towards the ones who overall are charged with the protection of all of us.
One major goal that we have is to tie federal funding of local police forces to a prerequisite that they provide data regarding their shootings, especially in the cases of when they're shooting unarmed civilians, and then also to tie that to the mandatory use of body cameras. So that's a huge goal because I think transparency is necessary. I don't think there's enough data out there, and so that's another reason why people are able to dismiss this issue. Another goal is to have an independent prosecutor to prosecute police in cases of police violence, especially against unarmed people, because I think it will restore faith for those of us who have lost it in our criminal justice system. People believe that the grand jury system is antiquated and leaves police to kill with impunity. And so I think that this would be one way to help resolve that issue.
You know, a lot of people ask me, like, why do I protest? And because it's an ongoing problem, and I can pretend that it's not going on. I can pretend that it's not happening, but there will be a new hashtag to learn. There'll be a new face the next day. And so we continue to march and move forward and get more organized and get serious, because I don't want my children to still be marching. My grandparents marched. My mother was involved in activism work. And so I don't want to pass this along. I want to be able to tell them the story of how we overcame, how we were able to come together and fight this greater evil, and just, I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
You don't know when the catalyst will be in place. Why did Rosa Parks become the catalyst as opposed to the earlier black woman who sat down on the bus just a few months earlier? It's hard to say when the spark in place takes off, the fire begins to expand, intensifies, and next thing you know, you got a whole host of people on fire for justice. And lo and behold, people take off and it becomes contagious. You don't know when it's going to become contagious. It is contagious now. We are still living in the moment of Ferguson, Baltimore, and things will continue and I hope intensify.
I
was told that I'm an activist from the way that I've been doing. I never thought I would be doing this type of work. I've never been the talkative type of person, this outspoken, but this made me who I am. And, you know, this is my life mission right now, like, to become an activist, become a civil rights lawyer, you know, to bring justice some way, somehow to America. This helps me. This helps me a lot. Speaking to people and being out here is more of a support than, you know, shutting down or just crying all the time. I believe that the reforms is going to happen, but I believe that it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot of powerful people to be on the same page. What do I fear the most? That when my daughter get older, this will still be going on with no change.
Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, given the depth of white supremacy in America, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the Black lives that are the last ones that have value. But the indigenous lives will matter, the Asian lives, the white lives, the brown lives, if Black lives matter. That's what makes that movement so crucial. And I'm just so very proud and blessed to be an old school brother who's a small part of that movement led by young folk.
Well, for now, it seems that police brutality and racial injustice is not going to stop in the U.S. in the near future. And statistics show that many Black Americans are skeptical that their country will ever make the changes necessary for racial equality. Perhaps only time will tell if America will ever be the land of the free. And that's a wrap for this week. Hope you will join us next week for another Aperture. Goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.